Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. Well, you know, I got this request in the Q&As, I think. And, there's so much to talk about in the House of Grimaldi. Grace Kelly, Stephanie, Caroline, everything. Albert, Charlene. I mean, good stuff. Basically, for the last 70 years, it's been filled with gossip. I know that Princess Stephanie, when she was going through all her troubles, she was in the National Enquirer or Star or something every single week. There was a lot of demand. And I think it's because Grace Kelly, even though she was killed tragically, you know, didn't happen until 1982. She actually, you know, met Princess Diana when Diana was 19 and was mentioned in Diana's book. So it kind of, it's not going back in time too far. People, and you can still watch her movies and things like that. And I think people were really attracted to the whole situation in Monaco. And certainly lately with Charlene, it has been big news again. One of the things in Downton Abbey, you had this recurring theme where Americans were going over to England to basically financially support the dying royals who couldn't afford to keep up with their estates. And that was one of the big storylines. And between the years 1870 and 1914, there were hundreds of American heiresses that flooded the shores of Europe. And to this day, their influence and also the various lines can be traced through a lot of European households, including some royal ones. Princess Diana was descended from New York heiress Frances Work. The House of Croy was led by the grandson of an American heiress. And Americans have always been fascinated by titles. I guess it's maybe because we don't have them. And that could be whether the royal titles, noble titles. I mean, you just think of something like Countess Luann. She loves being called Countess. Did. She's not really allowed to use it anymore. But as soon as there was, you know, the opportunity, Scott Disick, you know, because he could buy the title Lord. And they've just, Americans have always been fascinated. And prior to this massive flood of American girls in the late Victorian era, you know, there was a little wave earlier prior to that in the 1780s to 1830s. In 1798, daughter of the governor of Pennsylvania, married the Spanish minister to the United States, the first U.S. Chief Justice, John Jay. He had two granddaughters who married became viscounts. So just there were a lot of this going on. But then in about the 1830s, it kind of stopped. And then 1874 was kind of, hey, let's get right back at it again. Because what you had was you had the marriage of Jenny Jerome of Brooklyn, New York, and Lord Randolph Churchill, second son of the 7th Duke of Marlborough. And Jenny and Randolph probably never thought their impulsive love match would, you know, get everybody in America, hey, this is a new way to social climb. And you had her friends, Consuela Isinaglia. She got married to the Duke of Manchester, and Minnie Stevens got married to Colonel Arthur Paget. And this is kind of the thing. And newly rich mothers made a mad dash for London and Paris. And that's, they could just see that, hey, let's go take our daughters over to Europe and we'll marry them off to somebody rich or somebody with a title. But not everything ran smoothly. I mean, Jenny's mother-in-law looked at her as strange, abnormal, and habits and manners looking something between, a quote, a red Indian and a Gaiety girl. In 1895 alone, 9 American heiresses married titled British men, including a duke, an earl, 3 barons. But there was a flaw in the plan, and something that's referred to in Downton Abbey, too. Because only the eldest son gets a title. Only the eldest son put him in line to inherit a greater one. for Catholic American girls and those who were too impatient to wait for a father-in-law to die, the hunt on the continent yielded better results. One could become a princess. That's better than a duchess. So the next thing you know, Austria, Hungary, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, here you go. Here's a bunch of Americans. Now, Russia was not the place, you know, you really had to think about that one. Because of the weather, the Romanovs were not particularly friendly, but there was a ton of princely titles. And, you know, you even had Harriet Blackford, who wanted to marry Grand Duke Nicholas. And a lot of these alliances ended dreadfully, just because they didn't look at Americans kindly, they just wanted their money. But, you know, some women did, you know, prove out to be great and assisting their husbands. There was a woman by the name of Mary Leiter, and she married a guy named George Nathaniel Curzon in 1895. And she eventually became the Viceroy of India, which is essentially the highest social and political position in the British Empire behind the Queen. Even Joseph Chamberlain, who had a controversial political career, married an American, Mary Endicott. There was an American heiress named Anita Rhinelander Stewart, and in 1909 she met Prince Miguel de Braganza, whose father was referred to as the pretender to the Portuguese throne. And, you know, and then you had, of course, Grace Kelly. But before Grace Kelly, there was another American princess of Monaco, Alice Hine of New Orleans, and she was the widow of another Duke, Richelieu. So Alice married Prince Albert I of Monaco in 1889, and she worked hard to change the reputation of the principality from a gambling den to a place of culture. She established the opera house, installed a director who brought the world's greatest operas to Monaco. The relationship cooled a little bit because she decided to do some cheating. Took a series of lovers, including Isadora de Lara, and fed up with his wife, Albert made public their break when he slapped Alice in the face at the opera when she stopped to whisper to her lover. So she packed her bags in 1902 and left Monaco forever. They did not get divorced, though. When Albert died, they were still married. And Alice was interesting. She was born in the French Quarter of New Orleans in 1858 to a very wealthy family. Her mother was French. Her father was more German. But their stay in Louisiana was short-lived. When the American Civil War broke out in 1861, the family moves back to France. But when they go back to France, the Hines become influential figures in the court of Napoleon III. And the firm of Michael Hine, he even financed the entire Franco-Prussian War. And because of that, because of her parents, Alice was in this privileged position on the 19th century marriage market. And a few weeks after her 17th birthday, she marries the 7th Duke of Richelieu. So she's in the French nobility. And the marriage is kind of a step up for the social ladder because it was a new money family. But the marriage was cut short because in 1875, the Duke of Richelieu died during a trip to Athens. And so at 22, Alice is left widowed with two young children. So she goes about her life for a bit. And in 1879, she meets Albert I of Monaco in Madeira, Spain. And at the time, Albert was caught up in an unsuccessful marriage with Lady Mary Victoria Douglas Hamilton. So Albert and Alice begin a relationship in the early 1880s and marry in 1889. And Prince Albert I was deeply in love with her. It was one of the very first love marriages of the principality. And he married Alice against his father's wishes. Because even if she was the widow of the Duke of Richelieu, she was also Jewish, which was not what Prince Charles III, a deeply religious man, wished for the heir to the throne. And like I said earlier, they separated in 1902. They never had any children together. And Alice was fascinating to people at the time. She had friendships including Queen Alexandra of Britain, the writer Maupassant. She wrote all of her letters in red ink. And she was said to be Proust's muse. And there was written about her at the time, her American ancestry bequeathed her with great beauty and immense charm. But there's a myth around Alice, too. Because, as I said, she is described as Monaco's first American princess, seen as a predecessor to Grace Kelly. But really, she only lived in America 3 years. I mean, she was born in 1858. They left in 1861. So she really didn't have a lot of American in her. She was pretty much European in her ways. She probably didn't even have any American habits. Now, she is also said, like I said, to have been the inspiration behind the character of the Princess of Luxembourg in Proust's monumental novel In Search of Lost Time. However, maybe not. Nobody can be actually sure whether she was a model for Proust or not. And she did know Proust, but there's no proof of a close relationship between the writer and the princess. So they crossed paths, but was she the muse? She was also credited with having founded Monaco's first ballet company. But the ballet was created in 1912, and she had already separated from Albert in 1902. And at that point, she was persona non grata in Monaco. I mean, she did leave a culture dedicated to the arts. There's a beautiful avenue in Monte Carlo still bears her name. But Albert I was one of Monaco's most beloved princes, and she dumped him. So, you had other, you know, European royalty, you know, besides Lady Randolph Churchill, but the best known American heiress is the Duchess of Marlborough, Consuela Vanderbilt. And that's because she wrote her memoirs back in the 50s, and she was one of the wealthiest heiresses of her time. She had a dowry of approximately $2.5 million, which is equivalent to about $100 million now. And she married one of England's premier dukes who desperately needed the money. And she, in her memoirs, she talks about the vigorous training and tutoring enforced by her mother and the secret fiance she was forced to release when her mother set her sights on Consuelo marrying a titled European. Her mom actually pretended that she was dying to convince her daughter to accept the proposal. And she cried the entire way to her wedding, much like Charlene. The marriage was very unhappy because the Duke informed Consuelo he'd given up the woman he loved to marry her on their honeymoon. And by the birth of their second son, she is the one who coined the phrase, the heir and the spare. Their marriage was on the rocks. And when they petitioned for divorce 10 years later, the scandal rocked English society. And King Edward said, not happy about it at all. And apparently, the reason that they got a legal separation because Consuelo tried to elope with a Viscount who was also married. So eventually, everything settled down. Consuelo married somebody else. And American women continued to marry European noblemen after World War I. But the men were different and so were the women. And the devastation of the war created hundreds of nationless aristocrats, hundreds of fake aristocrats, and all of these people, they needed money. And as aristocrats, they were unaccustomed to work, had no qualifications for work, so they were just fortune hunters. But American heiresses, you know, because this new generation, they were free from parental control, they were susceptible to these kind of things. And they would step in to fund the Playboy lifestyle. It is often said that the tragedy that has befallen the Grimaldis over the years is because of a curse. The family was one of the most powerful names in Genoa. And they eventually became the foundation and royal family for Monaco by the end of the 12th century. and this sad string of unhappily ever afters for the present members of the royal family can basically be attributed to two of their ancestors being total creeps. The first, Francesco Grimaldi, was said to begin the family's eventual domination of the tiny city-state after he and his forces captured the fortress from rival claimants. He dressed himself up as a monk and successfully tricked the guards into opening the gates of the fortress. The second curse came after Lord Rainier I raped a young woman who later learned the ways of witchcraft. She used her knowledge of the dark arts to make sure that a Grimaldi would never find happiness in marriage. Now, I'm going to skip basically 600 years of this because we only want the good stuff. I get that. And I want the good stuff. I don't really care what happened in 1400 or 1500 or 1600 or 1700 or 1800. But in 1861, the Franco-Monegasque Treaty basically marked a new beginning for the principality and the Grimaldi family. It is the first time in the principality's history that the city-state is fully independent. And with its newfound independence, Monaco takes off. So Charles III ruled it from 1856 to 1889, and that's when Monaco became the Monaco that we know. It needed money. It had lost portions of territory to France. So Charles said, hey, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to build a casino and a spa. And basically bets everything on the casino. He enlisted a guy named Francois Blanc, a businessman from Provence who made his fortune by running a casino in Germany. And so Blanc creates this company to manage the Monte Carlo Casino. And gambling is banned in France and Italy. So, hey, the casino becomes a unique attraction on the Riviera. And it started bringing some of the richest Europeans to Monaco. So they expanded. They built a bunch of luxury hotels. And the district takes the name of the sovereign that built it, Monte Carlo, after Charles III. It is just a big-time revenue generator. And it's still around, the holding company that was established back in 1863. And it is also Monaco's biggest employer. And following the death of Charles, then you had Albert I, who I mentioned earlier. He was nicknamed the Navigator Prince or the Learned Prince because he devoted much of his life to oceanography, exploration, science. In 1902, he founded the Museum of Anthropology and Prehistory of Monaco. And in 1910, the world-renowned Oceanographic Museum. He was also responsible for Monaco's first constitution. And then he was succeeded to the throne by his son, Prince Louis II. And then Rainier ascended to the throne in 1949. And the country he inherited was in full expansion. And Rainier made Monaco the city-state it is today. He also did a new constitution, expanded the harbors and the sea, real estate development. He got him into the UN. And of course, he made the small city-state a capital of glamour thanks to his marriage to Grace Kelly. There's a lot of reasons he wanted to marry Grace. Despite all of the wealthy gamblers and everything coming, they were all from Europe for the most part. And the principality didn't really have a ton of money. They had very little because they were spending it. And they needed more people to come spend their money. And Grace was born in Philadelphia, 1929. And you see, Grace spent a lot of time in the Jersey Shore. And her dad, I mean, my goodness, Jack Kelly, this guy, I mean, he was success in all things. An honest guy, hard worker. In sports, he was celebrated for winning 3 Olympic gold medals in sculling. One newspaper called him the most perfectly formed American male. and he had a construction company, Kelly for Brickwork, and it was the largest of its kind on the East Coast. And apparently his sex drive was pretty huge too. And the little thing called marriage was not going to limit his love life, which he kept discreet, but extremely busy. And the Kellys have often been compared to the Kennedys. You know, charismatic Irish Catholic Democrats, civically and politically engaged. I mean, Jack once ran for Philadelphia mayor, and he lost by a couple of points. And Kelly women were, you know, just like the Kennedy women. You're outdoorsy, you're sporting, you're supportive of your men. But unlike the Kennedys, the Kellys were not social climbers. Because in the Philadelphia of those days, Irish Catholics, even rich ones, were outsiders. So they never lived in the very best part of town. Even though, when they wrote about Grace Kelly, the publicist, they said, oh, yeah, she grew up on the main line. Well, she didn't. Now, did they have a huge house? Yeah. 17 rooms. It overlooked the river where Jack rode. And they were wealthy. Very wealthy. And when the Great Depression came along, they stayed wealthy because Jack didn't ever put anything in the stock market. But Grace was not the sporty, athletic type. She didn't really fit in with the other Kelly kids. There was some story where one time her sister locked her in a cupboard and Kelly had her dolls with her and just stayed in there for hours just playing with the dolls. She was good at make-believe. That is what she did. And she loved being in the theater, started in school. She played the Virgin Mary in her convent school nativity pageant. And she did that all the way through high school. And nowadays, if you write what the press wrote about her then, we would call her an industry plant because they said, hey, it seems like she came out of nowhere. But that's not true. Because Jack Kelly had two brothers, and both of them were very big in the theater. You had Walter Kelly, who was in vaudeville, and then you had George Kelly, who was a Pulitzer Prize winning playwright. And it was George that Grace looked to in this whole acting thing. It was he who encouraged her dream of acting, who warned her about this studio system in Hollywood, and then whose name helped her win late admission to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. But Grace's parents didn't want her to go home for New York. They didn't. Jack Kelly, Grace's dad, thought acting was basically just a scooch above being, his words, a streetwalker. But everybody said, hey, she got away from home early. And the rest of the family didn't. They all had to stay. And they were kind of jealous that Grace got to leave. And she did theater, and she did it okay, but she didn't have a voice for theater. She loved it, but she was never going to get monster roles in the theater because her voice was too high. It didn't resonate out to the audience. But one thing that she did really well were the Playhouse television dramas that were just kind of making their way in the early 50s. And she actually made 30 television appearances. And one of them was in a shortened version of the play The Swan. And in the play, Grace as a princess must choose between young love and a destiny tied to duty. A life where she will glide like a dream on the smooth surface of the lake and never go on the shore. So she has to stay out on the lake. Silent, white, majestic. She also wore white gloves to auditions, which apparently nobody did at theater auditions back then. They didn't. And she would wear low-heeled shoes, slim wool skirts, little camel hair coat. She had glasses because she was nearsighted. And she hardly ever wore any makeup. And everybody mentioned at the time that, wow, her style of dress was very conservative. The circle pin, the white collars, very schoolgirlish. Her style was described essentially as small town high school teacher. And it's funny because she had a long-running relationship with Ola Cassini, who was a fashion designer. And they dated, engaged, and I'll talk about it a little bit. She possibly had an abortion also with Cassini's baby. And Grace's first film, 14 Hours, was not the one that kind of set her movie career in motion. And High Noon, of course, did put her on the map, but, you know, it wasn't just like a huge, hey, my gosh, it's Grace Kelly. But what kind of noticed her, or, you know, everybody noticed her for, was a screen test. Black and white screen test she shot for 20th Century Fox. It was in early 1950 for a movie called Taxi. And it was the part of a poor Irish girl. Now, Grace didn't get the role, but the test hung around. Everybody had seen this test. And in 1952, it caught the eye of John Ford, who said, quote, "This dame has breeding quality and class." And he cast her in Mogambo. And then a year later, Alfred Hitchcock saw the test. And he was in need of a leading lady for Dial M for Murder, because Ingrid Bergman had run off with the married director Roberto Rossellini, and she was basically considered banned. So Hitchcock sees this Taxi audition, plus a scene or two of High Noon, and he thought of her as Mousy, which to him was a compliment. And Grace was hired. And Hitchcock said, from the Taxi test, you could see Grace's potential for restraint. He liked what he called her sexual elegance. There's been a lot of talk since Grace died about her affairs or possible affairs or any affairs that she had while an actress. She did tell Prince Rainier that she was a virgin when they got married. However, that is not true. She'd actually lost her virginity at 17, just before she left home for New York City. And all these books, they say, okay, well, they make it seem like she slept with every guy who crossed her path. Now, Marie Rambo, who was a friend, said that just wasn't her style. And the thing is, when these books are written, there's still a lot of people alive who knew Grace Kelly. There is one biographer who I think is accurate, who claimed that Grace had affairs with Gary Cooper, Clark Gable, Roy Milland, William Holden, Bing Crosby, Cary Grant, Frank Sinatra. But others who are trying not to make it seem like Grace slept with everybody said, oh, William Holden, probably Milland, and maybe Gable. Well, they're wrong. I mean, they just are. This stuff's documented. You know, no. Is it documented that they slept together? No, but a lot of these guys were willing to give up their wives for Grace. And it's interesting that she was not banned like Ingrid was. And when Grace snagged her first major film role in High Noon, she had her first major affair with a co-star. On the set of High Noon, Kelly had an affair with Gary Cooper, who was married, 28 years her senior. And this, him being married and their age difference is kind of what every single relationship that Grace Kelly had moving forward. And this one, I mean, Gary Cooper talked about it. That's why it makes no sense for people to say, oh, no, she didn't. He talked about it. He said, quote, "She looked like a cold dish with a man until you got her pants down, then she'd explode." And in 1953, Grace started Mogambo, alongside Ava Gardner and Clark Gable. And basically an affair between Kelly and Gable was destined from the start. Because Kelly said, "Mogambo had three things that interested me. John Ford, Clark Gable, and a trip to Africa with expenses paid. If it had been made in Arizona, I wouldn't have done it." And when Grace Kelly and Clark Gable finally did get hot and heavy, somehow news of the affair reached Grace Kelly's mother, who flew out all the way to Africa to chaperone her young daughter. But by the time Mom got there, Clark Gable was done with Grace Kelly because apparently she was too clingy. And Grace Kelly admitted to this one, which is why I never understand when they said, oh, maybe Clark Gable. She was asked about the affair. She said, what else is there to do if you're alone in a tent in Africa with Clark Gable? In 1954, in The Country Girl, Grace starred alongside Bing Crosby, and Grace won an Oscar. Now, Kelly supposedly had an affair with Crosby while filming The Country Girl, and the night Kelly won an Oscar for her performance in the film, Bing Crosby reportedly went to her hotel room, expecting to spend the night with her, only to find Marlon Brando, who had beaten out Crosby for an Oscar earlier that night, in her bed. It is unlikely, though not impossible, that Bing and Kelly hooked up again when they reunited for High Society in 1956. I say because at that time she was already engaged to Prince Rainier, and the engagement ring's in the film because her character was engaged, so you had that 10.5 carat engagement ring. So that I'm doubtful about, but they had already had an affair, so I guess it's possible. When she was filming Dial M for Murder in 1954, her affairs kind of finally began to catch up with her. Again, she's in an affair with Ray Milland, and he had been married for more than 20 years. His wife finds out about him sleeping with Grace Kelly, and she throws him out of their house. And he was going to leave his wife for Grace Kelly. But then he realized, oh my gosh, look how much money it's going to cost me. So he ended up staying married to his wife until he died in 1986. And Kelly's affair with Ray almost cost her her career. Because you had Gossip columnist Hedda Hopper. She reported on the affair. She called Grace Kelly a nymphomaniac in the paper. I mean, Hedda Hopper, though. Oh, come on. She hated everyone who she morally disagreed with. And you also had to be heterosexual. But being branded a home wrecker almost destroyed Kelly's career. I mean, it was the 50s. You know, this is America going back to puritanical kind of roots. You weren't allowed to be anything other than a prim and proper lady. I mean, Ingrid. I said Ingrid was banned. Ed Sullivan blacklisted Bergman from his show. And the United States government literally called Bergman, quote, an instrument of evil. But that didn't happen to Grace. She avoided it. You know, after she married Prince Rainier, she becomes a real-life princess. But the prince wasn't the only royal that Kelly dated. And if you go back and you go read all my, the yachting ones, the celebrity sex ones with Bonnie and stuff, you will see that Grace Kelly was one of the original yachters. In the 50s, she dated millionaire playboy Prince Ali Khan, the leader of the Nizari Muslims. He gave her an emerald-studded gold bracelet. And usually, Prince Khan would gift women he dated a cigarette case with one emerald in it. And women with whom he slept, they got an emerald bracelet. And he went on to marry Rita Hayworth. Grace Kelly also dated the Shah of Iran. Why? Because he kept showering her with jewelry, including a gold vanity case with a clasp featuring 32 diamonds. Now, Cassini was engaged to Grace Kelly, kind of through all of this. And he didn't really care. And he was credited with giving Jackie Kennedy her signature look. Grace Kelly's parents hated Ola Cassini because of his Russian roots. He'd been married a few times. And Grace Kelly longed for her parents' approval, so she called off the engagement. But like I said, it was rumored that Kelly had been pregnant with Cassini's child, but terminated the pregnancy. We don't know if it was his. We don't know if it was from one of the affairs. Oh, and you know, also, talking about the Kellys and the Kennedys. You know, Grace Kelly and Kennedy, John F. Kennedy hooked up. Kelly and Kennedy, the families were friends. I mean, self-made Irish-American millionaires, of course. And so Grace Kelly and John F. Kennedy socialized even before they were famous in their own right. In the early 50s, Grace Kelly and Kennedy were in a romance so intense that they discussed marriage. But Kennedy's dad said no, 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 because he didn't want an actress to hinder his son's political career. So then John F. Kennedy marries Jackie, had back surgery. I think this was 1954. And to cheer up her husband, Jackie, who didn't know that Grace and John F. Kennedy had a relationship, a sexual one, had Grace Kelly visit Kennedy in the hospital. So Grace Kelly arrives. She's dressed as a nurse. And according to a gossip columnist, she performed oral sex on the recovering John F. Kennedy. A little bit better than Marilyn Monroe's happy birthday. There was William Holden, and Grace Kelly was with him in The Country Girl, and also The Bridges at Tokyo Re. So she had an affair with him, and he was also married at the time. And while tabloids would report on Grace Kelly's affairs. See, this is the other thing I don't understand when people say, oh, she didn't have any, or maybe one or two here like that. The tabloids were talking about it. And tabloids would get sued a lot easier back then. She was discreet, and she would make comments like, as an unmarried woman, I was thought to be a danger. And the fact that Kelly was seen as wholesome by the general public, despite her busy private life, was something that other Hollywood actresses commented on. I mean, Clara Bow, who I have talked about in this space, on the podcast, you know, on the site, said, Grace Kelly, however, will get away with having many lovers. Know why? The damn public will never believe it. And Zsa Zsa, you know, talked about for several episodes on the podcast, the one who had 9 husbands during her lifetime, said of Grace Kelly, she had more boyfriends in a month than I had in a lifetime. She went to bed with anyone she fancied at the time. It has also been rumored that Grace Kelly had an affair with Cary Grant, who she co-starred with in To Catch a Thief. And it's supposedly to have lasted several years, even while Kelly was married to Prince Rainier. But that one has never really been confirmed. I don't think I've ever seen Cary Grant say anything other than this one quote. He talked about Grace Kelly being his favorite leading lady. He said, with all due respect to Ingrid Bergman, I much preferred Grace. She had serenity. And Cary Grant, of course, had starred alongside Bergman twice. But he went on to say, Ingrid, Audrey, Deborah Kerr were splendid, splendid actresses, but Grace was utterly relaxed, the most extraordinary actress ever. And I had told you that Grace Kelly, before she got married to Prince Rainier, had to pretend to be a virgin. And she had a fertility test and some other things, and she claimed that she broke her hymen playing field hockey in high school. If you think about it, in 1954, when Rear Window premiered, I mean, Grace Kelly had only been in 4 movies. She was hardly known to the public. And then, boom, there she was, a star. You know, in 14 hours, that first movie, she was on screen for 2 minutes and 14 seconds. And then in High Noon, you know, she's the pacifist bride of Gary Cooper. And in The Mogambo, she was the prim wife of an anthropologist and Jane to big game hunter Clark Gable's Tarzan. If you think about it, it was this steep curve straight to the top. Because by the time Hitchcock got his hands on her, Grace Kelly was ready for my close-up, Mr. Hitchcock. And he gave her one after the other. 3 films, Dial M for Murder, Rear Window, To Catch a Thief. He called her a snow-covered volcano. Ladylike, but suggestive of icy Olympian heights. Untouched autonomy, yet beneath it all, unblushing heat and fire. And then by 1956, 2 years, 6 films, 1 Academy Award. After Rear Window, while the country was going, "Hey, who are you, Miss Kelly?" She was gone. Gone. To Europe to marry a prince, where she becomes Her Serene Highness Princess Grace of Monaco. Just like that, boom. I mean, it's just... And then she never really got to act again. Anyway, that will be it for this part. In the next installment, I'm going to talk more about Grace Kelly and how she met Prince Rainier and their strange courtship. That, of course, the wedding. And then the basically loveless marriage where he cheated on her, she cheated on him, whether she did cheat on Frank Sinatra, because they did buy a house together in France, so that way it was easier for them to cheat together. I mean, this was crazy, and that's even before you get to Stephanie and the accident, and whether or not it was murder or an accident. Did she have a stroke? Would she have lived if she hadn't been in the car and had the stroke? There's a lot to discuss. I mean, this is just the tip of the iceberg on the Grimaldis. All right, you guys, I will talk to you later.